Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our guest today is Dr. Walter Willett. He is chairman of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health. What we're going to try to do today is get some very reliable information on topics such as high fructose corn syrup, the omega-3 and 6 fatty acids, gluten, and of course your questions about health and nutrition. You can reach us with your questions and comments at any time during the program. In Anchorage, our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Willett has been chair of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health since 1991. His research involves dietary factors that cause and may prevent cardiovascular disease, cancer, and other issues. He uses epidemiology primarily to do this. And one of these problems that relates to this kind of approach is making sure you have good information about dietary intake, and his work includes really improving that effort, and also using some markers to really be sure that what people are saying they're taking, they really are taking. Dr. Willett, it's just a pleasure to have you back on Line 1 again.
Thank you. My pleasure to be with you.
Let's start with this common kind of personal joke that patient or that the public often has, is that today's caffeine is the best thing for us. 2 weeks from now, it's not so good. There's lots of contradictory information. And I would expand that to say that, you know, science is all about getting the evidence, but more and more we really need to appreciate the quality of the evidence. So could you maybe talk to us a little bit about how the public should interpret these different guidelines and perhaps even share an example of why this might be important?
Sure, and that is an issue that's of great concern, because a lot of people really do feel confused. And if I put myself in the position of a person in the general public, I think I would be confused about a lot of issues too, given what people hear and see in the media. And part of the problem is that there is some tendency for both investigators and parts of the media to sensationalize new findings. In part, that's how people get things published, is having something that's new and different. And definitely that's how you sell magazines, newspapers, evening news, is to have something that's latest and sensational and unexpected and sort of bust the myth and that kind of thing. But the problem is that the latest new finding is usually the least reliable finding. So when people hear about that and it's not put in the context of everything else we've learned over the years about the issue being studied, that latest finding is blown out of proportion. It's often misleading. And no big surprise, people end up confused. So there are now a lot of good health writers and journalists who do an excellent job of taking a latest finding and putting it in a context and say, you know, well, what have we known up until now, and what is the quality of this new study compared to what we've had before, and how does it fit together, and what we should really ask for and require before we change our diet or have other habits, is we should ask for studies that are confirmed. In other words, there's one report and it's not just taken on its own, but several other studies look at the issue, find the same results, and then that starts to become something that we can put more confidence in. And then there are also some studies are just inherently less reliable to some studies are just inherently less reliable and more likely to get wrong conclusions. In particular, there's a finding that a study that was reported just in the last week or so about egg consumption and heart disease. And people heard headlines or read headlines about several yolks of egg per week being almost as bad as smoking cigarettes in terms of risk of heart disease. But if you dig out the study, you would find that this was a simple cross-sectional study of people who came in one time to a clinic, and they had their coronary arteries examined, and there was a very limited questionnaire that they completed. And other aspects of diet, physical activity, other factors were not evaluated in that study, and those could be what we call confounding variables. And most importantly, there's a large body of evidence in this area. Other better designed studies that enrolled people while they were healthy got detailed data about diet and activity and other risk factors, and then followed people for decades to look at how egg consumption related to risk of heart disease. And those studies have consistently shown no appreciable increase in heart disease risk for eating up to one egg a week. So in that context, so there's a much larger body of evidence. This new finding is very meager, almost for sure not correct.
So this is an example of how you started off, is that it's sensational since it seems to contradict all the previous bits of information. It makes a lot of noise, but it probably is not going to stand the weight of time.
Almost for sure not, because there have already been many large studies that have looked at this. It deserves to be looked at again, but it's very unlikely that there would be something, an effect of egg consumption that was almost as bad as cigarette smoking. It's almost never possible to prove absolutely no effect. If something is very small, very weak, sometimes even the biggest and best studies can't detect it. But big studies have looked at this issue and not found any appreciable increase in risk of heart disease among generally healthy people. I might add that we and some other people have seen among people who already have diabetes, there does seem to be some relation between egg consumption and heart disease risk. But among generally healthy people, that there does not seem to be an increase in risk.
And one problem that I mentioned, and I think it's correct to say from some of my reading, is that a lot of nutritional studies are dependent often on, let me put it this way, much more poorly done nutritional studies that sometimes we hear about, are really dependent on recall of intake over perhaps even a long period of time, which is really quite hazardous in that, you know, you're asking people to recall what they may have eaten a week ago or even longer ago and try to make conclusions from that. And you, it seems to me from reading the information about what you're doing on your website, is that you're really trying to refine that and improve that methodology.
Right. We've spent actually almost the last 40 years looking at how we can improve our measurement of dietary intake, and it's definitely challenging. It's complicated. And if you want to have perfect information about what somebody eats over the long term, you're not going to learn anything, because that's really almost impossible. So we want to be able to capture most of the information, if not necessarily all of the fine details. And as it turns out, we've developed standardized questionnaires that, and we've evaluated them in many ways compared to detailed weighing and measuring, compared to measurements of nutrients in the blood or in the fat tissue. And basically, it shows that we can measure diet pretty well, not perfectly, but pretty well. But one interesting thing is that it's actually easier for people to report their intake over a longer period about what they usually eat. Say, we asked people over the past year. And that's easier in general than asking people, what did they eat for lunch 2 days ago? That's a lot harder when we ask people to be that specific. But people do have a pretty good idea about what they eat usually, even if they can't tell you what they ate at a specific meal several days in the past. So fortunately, what we usually want to know is what the longer-term diet is, and we can collect that pretty well. The other thing that's important is we update the information every several years as we go on in time, because people's diets change and the food supply is changing over time. So we're now about 32 years into follow-up, and if we had only had information when we started back in 1980, we'd be pretty out of date by now, but we update that as we go along.
All right. What I'd like to do is, well, let me do this. Let me go ahead and give our phone number again and contact information and remind people you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. And my guest today is Dr. Walter Willett. He is the chairman of the Department of Nutrition at Harvard School of Public Health. If you've got questions or comments, our local number, 550-8433, our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So let's talk about this high fructose corn syrup issue. It's important enough that Friday Night Live had a skit on it. I see high-profile physicians and scientists taking both sides of the coin that this is the worst stuff in the world and this is not such a bad thing, at least related to our obesity problems in the United States. Could you put all this in some perspective for us?
Sure. That there's unfortunately been too much of a focus on high fructose corn syrup, and there's no question that it is not good for us to be consuming this in the amounts that most Americans do, but it's really not appreciably different than regular sugar, what we call sucrose, that you the white crystals that you buy at the store and put in your coffee or tea. The regular sugar is 50% fructose, and the high fructose corn syrup is about 55% fructose, and the rest is mostly glucose. So there's really almost no difference between 55 and 50% fructose. So we should really think of this all as sugar, and high fructose corn syrup is just one form of sugar. But that said, it really is a problem that Americans are consuming far too much, that on average Americans get about 16% of our calories from sugar, and that's huge. One of the problems is much of that is consumed in the form of soda and fruit drinks, sports drinks, sugar water, basically. And that's particularly problematic because it's just far too easy to take a large amount of sugar when we drink it down as, say, a Coke or Pepsi. In fact, most people don't realize that the standard 20-ounce soda has about 17, 18 teaspoons of sugar in it. And if you can just imagine sitting at a table and eating 18 teaspoons of sugar, it's almost impossible. You just gag before you get that far. But you can gulp that down in a minute or two. And it does very bad things to us. We can see it's related to weight gain. It's related to risk of diabetes, heart attacks, gout, of course, dental caries, and obesity, too. And it's especially a problem not just that we can consume so much from an obesity standpoint, but when we consume sugar dissolved in water, like, again, your Coke or Pepsi, then we don't register those calories in the same way. So those calories tend to be added on top of what else we're consuming in our diet. Whereas if we had something solid, solid food you chew and swallow, we tend to develop satiety, and we unconsciously eat less of something else, but we don't do that in the same way with these liquid calories. I would want to add one additional expansion of this, though, that sugar is indeed a huge issue, especially in liquid form, but it behaves metabolically very similarly to white starch, like white bread, white pasta, white rice. And we consume massive amounts of that. We should include white potatoes in that same category. So you add up all the sugar, all that refined starch and potatoes, that's almost half of the calories in the U.S. diet, and it has almost no nutritional value. It makes us get fat. It gives us diabetes, gives us heart attack, and that's probably the single most important nutritional problem in this country at this time.
So just to make sure I understand it, it's not where you get your sugar, it is how much you are intaking of it that's the issue.
Absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And there's been such a focus on high fructose corn syrup that some soda companies have said, well, we're going to replace it with natural table sugar, natural cane sugar. Absolutely no difference. Mm-hmm. That's a bogus response.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that we have so much sugar access now compared to the past? What changed?
Well, that's an interesting, complex question, but I think the basic part of it is that we do have an innate sense of sweetness. And why do we have that? One of my colleagues has hypothesized that in our natural environment, maybe when we were living in trees, our ancestors lived mostly on leaves at that time, and you needed some way to detect the leaves that were young and tender and had carbohydrate that we could metabolize in that in the leaf for energy, because a mature leaf is all fiber, and we can't gain any energy, any calories that way. So we needed those calories, and this, following that sense of sweetness would lead us to calories that we could consume and were critical for survival. But we no longer live on leaves and are in forage. We have a massive industry that's producing huge amounts of sugar, very sweet, at very low cost. And essentially, the food industry has done lots of taste testing and product development to maximize the human sensation and desire to eat sweet things. So bit by bit, over time, we've ratcheted up the sweetness of our diet. And now people are basically accustomed, some perhaps even addicted, some people addicted to this very high level of sweetness. And so essentially our innate sort of evolutionarily derived senses have been exploited to maximize, get people to buy as many food products as possible, which is, of course, the desire of the food industry.
I can't help but to briefly address this issue of addiction, I'm not an addiction expert by any means, but what I'm beginning to understand about our central nervous system is that we set up circuits, neural circuits from exercise, and we do the same thing enough. So someone who grows up practicing the piano or the violin all the time, we can actually measure that, much like we might measure differences in muscle in somebody. So that is when you say addiction, are we talking about that we've really developed a taste pattern that gets reinforced over and over and over and over and over again, such that we are always going to have that hard wiring for that sugar in our brain, and we've just got to substitute a different way of approaching it? If that's true, do you think about that's the same way with cigarette smoking or exercise even?
Yes, this whole area is being investigated very rapidly now, and I think we'll have a clearer picture than we do today, several years in the future. But it does seem that there is this capacity for addiction to foods, and sometimes food in general, but often specific characteristics such as sweetness, such as saltiness. And it's very interesting. I think there's almost for sure a lot of variation from one person to another person, because I've talked with patients who could stop drinking soda, sweet Coke, overnight and just go right about it, and it was no problem for them. But then other people who describe their struggle to get off of Coke with just like somebody trying to get off of drugs, a real, real struggle. So I think there's caffeine, other substances, smoking too. Some people can stop rather easily. Other people find it extraordinarily difficult to do that. So underneath this is a lot of variability, but it does seem like there really is something to this idea of food addiction.
Okay, good. Thanks very much. Here's an email we've got. The writer says, are there any helpful tips you can provide about reading nutrition labels? How do I know, she asks specifically, when something has too much sugar or, different subject, too much salt?
Right. It's very hard to tell looking at labels. Partly on the ingredients list, sugar is often hidden in many different ways. Sometimes it's called evaporated cane crystals. I mean, that's sugar, basically, or dextrose. Very often now fruit juice, especially apple juice, is being added. And I should have mentioned that fruit juice has almost as much sugar as a Coke does. So it can be very confusing just trying to understand what's actually in there. But it's helpful to look at the line on the nutrition facts where it says sugar, and there's a number there, and about 5 grams is 1 teaspoon. So you can do a little calculation from that to see how many teaspoons of sugar is in that product. And in general, sugar doesn't have to be zero, but it's if it's going over 5 grams or about a teaspoon, that's more sugar than most of us really need than anybody really needs on a regular basis.
How about the salt question? It was something I was going to get into if we had time. She asked about telling how much salt maybe from a package, but you maybe want to generalize more about our salt intake and its importance in this country.
Right. While it's been controversial, there's unequivocal evidence now that reducing salt will reduce blood pressure, which is a major risk factor for stroke and heart disease. And it's also very clear that we consume far more salt than we need, that traditional societies that have not been part of the industrial diet often consume amounts of salt that are one-fifth as much as Americans on average consume. So we just, and those societies, by the way, have very little cardiovascular disease. Of course, lots of factors feed into that. But the bottom line is we're consuming far more than we need, and almost everybody will benefit by reducing salt intake. So how do we do it? Essentially, it's in our diet that most salt comes from processed, manufactured foods. So if you really eat food that is prepared at home and we don't add much salt to it, then we're not going to have very much salt. If you normally have a salad and you make the salad with oil and vinegar and seasonings, make the salad dressing with that, then it's going to be very low salt. But if you go to a restaurant, you can easily get a salad that has a third of your daily allowance in just that salad, or even half the daily allowance. Some of the dressings and seasonings have so much salt put in them. Sometimes miss the major sources of salt. In the U.S., the number one source is bread. It's not potato chips or pretzels or things like that, but people eat bread on a regular basis. It has quite a bit of salt in it, even if you don't think of it as a salty food, but it adds up to a large amount. Soups are often another very major soup. Grains, potatoes, starch sources, when you eat at a restaurant or get commercially made products, they usually have a lot of salt. Some people at home preparing rice, for example, often automatically add salt, which really astonished me. I did never do that. And if you add other seasonings, you can flavor it and make it very tasty in many, many different ways. So there's no one single step you can take to eliminate, or you don't have to eliminate, we need salt, some salt, but to reduce salt intake. But the main way to go is to avoid manufactured foods, things you buy in packages as much as possible, and do most of your food preparation at home.
What about the omega fatty acid issues? We hear a lot about omega-3 and omega-6. So what's the importance? What do we need to remember here?
It depends how deep you want to go. The simplest thing that we need to remember, if we don't want to get into the biochemistry, is try to include fish in your diet twice a week or more, and use a variety of healthy plant oils instead of vegetable shortening or animal fats. And that will give us a good amount of both omega-6 and omega-3s. If you want to go a little deeper into this, the omega-3 and omega-6 are two kinds of unsaturated fatty acids, and we call them essential because we can't live without them. And those fatty acids have many different functions. They make up the membrane that surrounds every cell in our body. They make up the large majority of our brain and our spinal cord. They provide the backbone for a number of different hormones that affect clotting, heart arrhythmia, inflammation. So they have many, many functions in terms of our sort of machinery and also the structure of our body. There's been some belief that that omega-6 fatty acids are bad for us and omega-3s are good for us, and that the ratio of omega-3s to omega-6 fatty acids is critical. But that is really mythology, and there's a lot of data now, many different types of studies, to show that that ratio is really irrelevant. And the main point is to get adequate amounts of both omega-3 and omega-6 fatty acids. And in general, to go back to my first point, the omega-3s are present in fish and some plant oils, canola oil and soybean oil, and the omega-6s are present in almost all the plant oils, plus seeds and some in nuts. So that's a simple story.
Okay. So far, what I've got written down is decrease the total intake of sugars, decrease processed grains, decrease salt, fish twice a week, and decrease animal sources of oil, more vegetable oils. Am I with you?
Right, yeah. When we're talking about decreasing the refined grains, that is, with a little creativity, relatively hard because you can usually do it as a swap for whole grains. In other words, have brown white rice instead of white rice. White rice, have whole grain bread if you're going to have some bread instead of white bread. And there's a lot of other grains that people are just in this country starting to learn about, like quinoa and barley and oats, of course, have been a whole grain that's been around for a long time but has been sort of forgotten. That's it's a great way to start a day with some nuts and fruit added to it. So a lot of what we're talking about isn't really just giving up a whole big area, but doing some swapping to replace unhealthy versions with healthy versions.
Okay. I think this is a good place to take our short break. I want to remind listeners you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll rejoin our guest, Dr. Walter Willett, as we continue to discuss nutritional issues. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Line 1, your health connection, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Line 1, your health connection on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, originating from KSKA Anchorage. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Walter Willett. He's chairman of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health. We've discussed high fructose corn syrup. We've been talking a little bit about some of the fatty acids, what we do know and how we know what we know about nutritional issues that are useful for us. If you've got health or email questions, you can also email us directly at line1@alaskapublic.org. Our phone number again is 550-8433 and our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And as you just heard, remember, between 7 and 8, if that's when you're listening to this program, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast. Let me also point out that you can listen to the program at any time by going to alaskapublic.org and clicking the Line 1 link. We keep all of these programs available to you. You can also find them at iTunes as well. And there are a couple of links we put on each program. There's an excellent 15-minute video of Dr. Willett talking about diet and taking charge of your health. There's a link to that YouTube video as well as the Nutrition Source webpage of the Harvard School of Public Health and a nursing health study that has some useful information that we may or may not get to here shortly. There is a question that's come in by email that relates to unsweetened beverages and artificial sweeteners like sucralose and saccharin and aspartame. And it's a couple of questions. Are they responsible for the Gulf War syndrome or the metabolic syndrome? And what are your advice on safe amounts?
Well, yeah, good question. That there's no question that the regular sugar sweetened beverages do contribute in a major way to the metabolic syndrome and risk of diabetes. The artificial sweeteners have been hypothesized to possibly contribute by stimulating different hormone releases in the brain, but we've looked at this pretty carefully and we don't see any increased risk of diabetes and the precursor metabolic syndrome. due to these artificial sweeteners like sucralose and aspartame. But having said that, I don't think that artificially sweetened beverages are the healthiest, the optimal solution either, because they do leave us conditioned to a high level of sweetness. So it's harder to appreciate a fresh young apple or a fresh young carrot that has this delicate natural sweetness if we're really have an expectation of this very high artificial level of sweetness. So I consider these like a nicotine patch. They're a whole lot better than the real product, the soda, but they're not the ideal solution either. And some people can use them to help them transition out of full sugar beverages. So I think they have some role, but again, that's not the perfect solution.
All right. What about stevia?
Yes, that is a natural sweetener. It's very high in fructose, though. It's probably not the best solution. If we're going to want a little bit of sweetness, just use regular sugar. We don't have to totally avoid sugar, but just use it in small, limited amounts. And if we do that, I don't think stevia is going to be any better than just a modest, a small amount of regular sugar.
Okay, Alan.
One good thing about stevia is it costs a lot more, and you're less likely to overdo it. So there's some little built-in safeguard.
All right, Alan, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hello, thanks for taking my call. I just had a comment/complaint about public schools, and I grew up in Yakutat, and I growing up kind of noticed that there's a lot of kind of high sodium foods being served in the school, and I'm sure it's, you know, like that everywhere else. And I got to asking why they don't serve like wild caught salmon and game like moose and deer and stuff, and kind of was told that you know, things like that aren't approved by like the FDA or I don't know if it's the FDA or not, or you know, screened by somebody, that they're not allowed to serve all this wonderful food in the public school system. And I think it's a little ridiculous that we have up here in Alaska all this great access to this food, and we're not allowed to feed it to the children in school. And I guess I'll get your take on that, and I'll take my answer off here. Thanks.
Okay, Alan, thanks. So Alan's kind of asking, what about natural foods that are available in many parts of the country, particularly up here in maybe they're not allowed, and that's the problem. Do you have any comments?
Yeah, I don't know the exact situation there, but in general, this area of food in school has been a huge problem. And traditionally, we regard school lunch program as a dumping ground for agricultural surpluses, and most of those surpluses were quite unhealthy foods that almost by definition they were manufactured to have long shelf life, and so much of the nutrition was taken out of them. There's been a lot of interest and recognition in the last few years that this is an important area, and the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine has done a major review and recommended much stricter standards for what's served in schools, and cutting way back on sodium intake and refined starches, for example, and increasing fruits and vegetables. But believe it or not, some people in the Senate was from Maine and Idaho passed a law saying that potatoes are should be a vegetable, and they're not really. They're a starch source that has unhealthy effects in terms of diabetes and weight gain. And they got that potatoes and pizza declared as vegetables that have to be included in the school food programs. So there's been politics is behind some of this, but still we are making some progress step by step and slowly, and there's a long way to go yet. The issue of using more some local foods, definitely in the new guidelines, local fruits and vegetables are strongly encouraged. And wild salmon, I'm sure, would be encouraged too. It's a cost there. It may be an issue because at some places it can be sold for a lot more than you could. You could make a lot of money instead of giving it to school. So that is, economics plays a factor. There, some of the wild game, a really interesting question, and I would think that there should be a role, and I don't really know what the barriers would be to using that in schools.
Okay. Let me switch tracks just briefly and then comment on another thing that I must see at least a couple of times weekly, and that is concern about gluten and gluten sensitivity. And it appears to me that many individuals do not understand. I think it's easy to find where the sources of gluten is, but what gluten sensitivity is, what it really causes, what celiac disease is, and what wheat allergy is. Could you help put some, educational perspective on this issue?
Right. It's become a big issue in the public's eye. And definitely gluten sensitivity or allergic response to gluten is a very serious medical condition, and it causes bowel disease, and people can actually die if they continue to eat gluten and they have this condition. Fortunately, it's the severe form is pretty rare, but it is really critical that those people do not consume gluten at all. And there's another group of people who, if we measure their blood antibodies, a few percent, maybe 1 or 2%, have antibodies to gluten and don't have these symptoms. And it's really not clear what that means in terms of health. But there's probably a much larger group of people that think they're gluten sensitive. They say they feel better, or it's almost become a fad diagnosis, and don't really have gluten sensitivity. But some of these people actually do feel better when they go on a gluten-free diet because they're eating a healthier diet.
Right. Good point. Yeah.
They'll be not eating all that white bread and white pasta and white rice. It could have the white rice, but the gluten is mostly coming from wheat and a few other grains. And so given that most of those grains in our diet are the refined, unhealthy versions, a lot of people do feel better when they go on a gluten-free diet. And if you do it in a good way, there's no harm in doing it.
Okay. Let me take another phone call. Kimberly, you're on line one.
Hello?
Hi, what can we do for you?
Hey, I have two kids. One's Asperger's syndrome and the other one is rather hyperactive. And I don't give them sugar with soda, but sometimes we're out and picnicking or what have you, and people have soda, and I'll give them the diet soda. And a lot of people, they wag their fingers at me and they tell me, that's worse than sugar. Don't give them the diet, this, that, and the other, because it causes hyperactivity or it exasperates it somehow. Is that true or...
Okay. Yeah, I don't think there's any evidence for that, and I think it's extremely unlikely that that would really be a problem. This is an area where we clearly need more research, but at the moment, especially if it's just occasional, it's really unlikely that that would be an important issue. You're probably the best one to judge if it does seem to affect their behavior in an adverse way.
I've not noticed any fact. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Maybe it's a time to just point out that, even people still think that sugar causes hyperactivity, and I haven't asked what your thought is, but I think it's important to note people need to pay attention. If a child gets hyperactive when they eat an artificial sweetener, and are they different when they not, so that we look at more closely at cause and effect. Your comments on this, what I just said, and the relationship between sugar, however we want to define sugar, and hyperactivity.
Yeah, I think it's partly how we consume sugar, that if we do drink, a kid has a standard 20-ounce Coke, that will cause a major metabolic response, and it does cause our blood sugar to go skyrocketing up, even if the serving size is not 20 ounces, but even if it was 10 or 12 ounces. And then our pancreas does pump out a big blast of insulin to bring that sugar down. And often by a few hours, 3 or 4 hours, kids are getting hypoglycemic, or adults too. And then our body does pump out more adrenaline and some hormones to bring the blood sugar back up to where it should be. And some kids do get a response that looks like hyperactivity. To that big swing in blood sugar, which is, it's really not a healthy thing to be happening at all. So Even if it wasn't causing hyperactivity, that's not a good thing to be to be doing.
Right, and that does provide a mechanism. And I guess I've always argued that if you eat a big meal, most of us would, or have a lot of food, we get a little bit more lethargic more often rather than hyperactive. But I kind of appreciate your comment on at least providing a mechanism where this could happen. And that gets into this idea of high and low glycemic index foods, which you've kind of alluded to. Would you mind defining that for us?
Right. That is really an important concept for people who are interested in diet and being healthy. And the high glycemic kind of carbohydrate basically means it's a carbohydrate that we digest very quickly and turn that carbohydrate into blood sugar. And that's very easy to do after drinking a soda because the sugar is already dissolved, and half of that is that sugar is glucose. It goes right into our blood, and the blood, which is glucose in the blood, is what we call blood sugar, and it goes up right away. But we can also get a big rise in our blood glucose by consuming starch that is very easily digestible. And that's if it's been refined, and especially if it's been milled into flour, that creates tiny particles, very fine particles of starch in our enzymes in our stomach. Break that starch up into glucose molecules within minutes. And again, it's absorbed very quickly, and our blood sugar goes skyrocketing up. And we now have evidence, really definitive evidence, that rapid rise in blood sugar and then our response to put out a large amount of insulin to bring the blood sugar down, that metabolic response increases our risk of diabetes. And it also has adverse effect on our blood cholesterol fractions, which are related to heart disease. Interesting in this area, probably the most definitive study was not a dietary study, but a drug study that used a drug called acarbose, which essentially blocks the enzymes in our intestine from breaking the starch molecules into glucose. In other words, it's really taking high glycemic food and converting it by means of a drug into a low glycemic food. And you can. It's easier to give people a pill or placebo than it is to get people to change their diets in a major way. So in a long-term study, people given the acarbose, in other words, reducing the glycemic effects of their diet, had reduction in diabetes and heart attacks. So I think that really made the case that this difference in the form of carbohydrate is really important. So how do you have a lower glycemic diet than a high glycemic diet? The most important thing is to get rid of the refined grains and as much as possible, and use potatoes quite sparingly because they're very high glycemic, and use more intact whole grains. In other words, whole grains like barley, like oatmeal, brown rice, instead of grains that are pulverized and made into flour and consumed as bread, for example. In particular, cut down on beverages that contain sugar. That is also a very important step to take.
Okay. Another question that came in is there a significant difference between eating beef that might have been grass-fed versus corn-fed?
The reality is that no one really has any long-term data to look at grass-fed versus corn-fed beef. There are some modest differences in the fatty acid composition. In general, the grass-fed beef will be more lean because it's the animal's more active, and there'll be somewhat more unsaturated fatty acids in the grass-fed beef. But I think those differences are probably not large enough to make a major difference. And what we see, the adverse effects of eating red meat are not necessarily due to the fat. I think a lot of it is due to the cholesterol and probably the high amounts of iron in the red meat. And all of that's basically in the lean part, not the fat part of the meat. So I think it's an open question. The best thing to do is to keep the total red meat low. So I think it's maybe best to have some grass-fed beef if you like it once in a while, but not have it on a daily basis.
Okay. Thanks. Megan, you're on line one.
Hi. You actually were my pediatrician when I was younger, Dr. Woodard.
Be careful here, Megan.
Right.
What can we do for you?
I'm not that old.
Oh, good.
My question was about fruit, and I've read a lot of different opinions on whether or not you should eat fruit, that fruit, like if you want to lose weight as your primary goal, that fruit is not good to eat, and then they have Weight Watchers with 0 points for fruit. What is your take on the fructose and sugar from fruit?
Probably I think it's most important to look specifically at the different forms or different types of fruit. They're not all the same. That's pretty obvious. And we respond metabolically differently to them. First of all, fruit juice definitely should not count as fruit. It really should be almost more like soda. And if you have it at all, have just one small glass a day. It really has pretty much the same amount of sugar as soda. So that's an important distinction. And then some foods like bananas, which is apparently the number one fruit consumed in the United States, that actually is pretty high glycemic because we usually eat them when they're ripe. And that is probably not a great thing to eat on a regular basis if you're on a diet. But on the other hand, an apple is really low glycemic. And it's an interesting contrast. If you have the apple juice or the cider, it's really high glycemic. But when we have it in the apple form, the juice is encased in cells, and we have to chew and then break down. Our gastrointestinal system needs to break those cells apart and release the carbohydrate inside, which it does very slowly. So we get a much lower rise in blood glucose, and the fiber and that sense of fullness helps us maintain satiety for a much longer time after consuming an apple than apple juice. So apples are, when we've looked at this, have been one of the foods that are related to less weight gain. So we're doing some more analyses now, actually focusing in on specific fruits and specific vegetables, and hopefully we'll have a more complete answer to that. But almost for sure, they're not all the same.
Okay. So it's more the glycemic index than the sugar amount.
Yes, I think that's the most critical part. And one thing, it's just to keep in mind that if you take oranges and squeeze them into orange juice, you probably know it takes about 3 oranges to make a glass of orange juice, and then you can just chug it down in a minute. But almost no one would ever eat 3 oranges. So if we eat the whole fruit, it's going to slow us down and make us feel more satiated. And that helps us cut down on calories and without being hungry.
Okay, thank you.
Quick question from an email. Is there any connection between omega-3 oils and dry eye syndrome? You heard that one?
Yes, right. Actually, there's good studies showing that the plant form of omega-3, specifically called alpha-linolenic acid, does help the symptoms of the dry eye syndrome. And so that is part of the treatment for dry eye syndrome. It's good to, I think, check in with your ophthalmologist to make sure there's nothing else going on. But if you talk about this with your ophthalmologist, I'm sure they would usually recommend making sure that we're getting enough alpha-linolenic acid. Sometimes people prescribe capsules of oil, usually flaxseed oil that's high in omega-3 fatty acids. That's one way to reliably get it.
What about the use of like fish oil supplements to get your omega-3 acids, fatty acids? Are the supplements a good idea? Can they be abused? What do we need to know here?
Well, I think for some people the supplements can be helpful. There have been randomized trials where the consumption of fish was pretty low, and in those studies the supplements of omega-3 fatty acids did reduce heart disease and particularly sudden cardiac death. And it's pretty clear now that one of the most important benefits of omega-3 fatty acids is to prevent arrhythmias of the heart, and that's really important because most people who die of heart disease actually die of these fatal arrhythmias that often come on top of a heart attack. So I think if someone has heart disease already, angina, or have a heart attack, it's probably a good thing to take some omega-3 fatty acid supplements to be sure you're getting enough of the omega-3s, unless you're really eating a generous amount of fish on a regular basis. But for an average healthy person, having fish twice a week along with a variety of plant oils is probably going to give you enough omega-3 fatty acids.
Well, let me ask.
I guess I would just point out, too, that if we eat fish, we're usually not eating something else, and fish has a lot of healthy nutrients in it, and if we're eating that instead of red meat, that's going to usually be a good trade-off, and so that's going to be a better total diet than eating a bunch of red meat and taking fish oil supplements on top of it.
Now, let me ask the big one. Most of us, or many in the United States and all the developed world, are now struggling with being overweight, and what's the basic fundamental bit of information that people really have got to understand if they're going to get back and lose weight and get back to a more healthy weight?
Well, there's no one single silver bullet answer to that question, unfortunately. If there were, we'd probably not have the problem that we do now. And the reality is that there are many different factors that have essentially literally fed into the obesity epidemic, and so there's no one simple solution. But just looking at the, in the end, it really does make a big difference. A key issue is how many calories we consume. But just cutting back on calories is usually very difficult for most people in the long run and usually doesn't work very well. What I think has become clear in the last few years is that the quality of the diet can make it easier to control our calories, or if it's bad quality diet, to make it more difficult to control our calories. And we published a very detailed analysis about a year and a half ago now in the New England Journal of Medicine, looking at many different aspects of the diet. And again, no big surprise, there was no magic bullet in all of that, but we identified many different foods that were related to either more weight gain or less weight gain. Not surprisingly, the biggest single factor was soda consumption, and that's important partly because many people consume so much. The average serving in some parts of the U.S. population is 3 servings a day, and that's just huge. But we found in general that potatoes, refined starches, red meat, and sweets were related to more weight gain, and whole grains and vegetables and fruit and nuts especially and yogurt were related to less weight gain. So what that really describes is shifting away from what most people are eating in this country to more Mediterranean-type diet. And there have been a series of studies now that have shown that dietary pattern, the more Mediterranean-type diet of whole foods, but it does require most people to control their weight. But it does require constant attention to it. There's just so much food in front of everybody every day, almost all the time, that we really have to be paying attention to what we do eat. And the other half of the equation, of course, is physical activity. And almost everybody, to control their weight, needs to consciously build some activity into their daily lives.
Okay. I have another phone call. Richard, I want to remind you, we just got about 4 minutes or so. What's your question?
Yeah, I just had a quick question about alcohol intake. And my understanding is that, you know, small amounts of alcohol, you know, 1 or 2 glasses of wine a day, can actually be beneficial for health, sometimes cardiac, kind of in that area. So I was just wondering if that's accurate or not.
Good question.
Yes, it's definitely true. There are many studies that have shown that moderate alcohol consumption, 1 or 2 drinks a day, does reduce risk of heart disease and diabetes as well. But there are a few caveats there. One is that it won't have any benefit for somebody who's not really at risk of heart disease. So if you're age 20 or 30, then you're not going to have a benefit from that moderate alcohol consumption, and the adverse effects in terms of traffic accidents and other conditions will clearly outbalance the benefit. And for women, it's also complicated because that 1 or 2 servings a day of alcohol does increase the risk of breast cancer, and that's obviously a big concern for women. It is the number one cause of death for women in middle age. And for many people, that would lead them to shift downwards in their intake. And then, of course, there always is the issue of alcoholism and really developing uncontrolled consumption of alcohol. And if somebody has a problem of drinking in their family, then it's probably better not to be drinking at all.
Okay.
So a complicated story.
Thanks for your call, Richard.
Thanks.
Appreciate it. We've got a couple minutes left, and sometimes it's nice to roll up with your final thoughts and comments. What do you want to make sure we remember or take out of this take away from today?
Well, I think probably what's really important is the recognition of how important diet is in our long-term health and well-being. We used to just think of it as good for preventing heart disease, but it's even astonished me, who has been studying this for now about over 30 years, that almost every outcome we look at is influenced strongly by diet and physical activity. And what we see is that if we really adopt a good package of diet and activity and not smoking, we could prevent over 80% of heart disease, over 70% of stroke, over 90% of type 2 diabetes. But sadly, very few people are taking advantage of that information. So there's huge opportunity for improving health.
I got a minute or two left, so I got to ask you, what's your most frustrating nutrition myth?
Well, we've spent a lot of time on the myth that the best diet is a low-fat diet and a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. And I think the evidence never supported that, and there now are many, many studies which don't support that. The type of fat and the type of carbohydrate are really very important, though. I think that's taken a long time to shift thinking, but it is happening now.
Okay. Well, I really want to express my appreciation. It's been wonderful to have you on. Hopefully our guests or our listeners have appreciated as much as I have. It's just been wonderful for you to take the time to be with us today.
Well, glad to be with you. Thank you.
You have a good afternoon.
Thanks.
All right. My thanks to today's guest, Dr. Walter Willett. He was chairman of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health, and I hope everyone appreciated his expert opinion. The bottom line is diet and activity and not smoking is very important to our health and to our outcomes. And he has elicited how to do that very well. So I'd encourage you to get your friends or loved ones to listen to the podcast. You can always go to alaskapublic.org to line one and listen to this program at any time. If you'd like to continue some more conversation about the program, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at our website, alaskapublic.org. Next week, we're going to change tune a little bit, and we're going to be talking about physical and occupational and speech therapy with some friends from the Alaska or the Ability Pediatric Therapies group here in Anchorage. So why don't you join us September 10th as we discuss those topics. Let me remind you that Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and helped us today with our audio engineering. I want to say thanks to everyone for listening. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line One, Your Health Connection is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400.